May it please the court. On March 13, 2009, 12 to 15 state troopers and members of the governor's task force descended upon a private party at the pipe fitters and plumbers banquet facility in Newark and ordered all the members of the Thunder Guards motorcycle club who were providing unpaid security at the party to exit the building, where they were encircled by a barrier of state police and instructed to provide their identifications and pedigree information.
And how many of them were there?
I'm sorry?
How many Thunder Guards were there?
10 to 12, I think the testimony was.
So roughly a one-to-one ratio?
Roughly one-to-one. There was no request for police assistance. There were no complaints by anybody at the party about the Thunder Guards being there. They were actually invited. There was no allegation by the state that any criminal activity was afoot. And the police admitted and acknowledged that they were not going to cite or arrest anyone. The state argued below that although the police had no reasonable suspicion to detain anyone, that no detention ever occurred, couching the incident as a consensual encounter. The state now concedes in this court that the actions of the state police clearly constituted detention, as the police engaged in conduct that would communicate to any reasonable person that they were not free to leave, per Jones v. State. In this case, even under the federal standard, that is less stringent. There was a detention as any time you move someone from point A to point B, as in Florida v. Royer, there's a detention. The safe position at this point is that it was really more of a regulatory inspection, citing New York v. Berger, which is a Supreme Court case dealing with a junkyard in Brooklyn, where the New York Police Auto Crimes Division, who made about 5 to 7 inspections every day throughout the metropolitan area.
Excuse me. Twice now you've mentioned at this point or at this stage, words to that effect. Are you suggesting that there were arguments that are fundamentally important to the appeal today that were not presented to the court below?
Not at all. What I'm saying, Justice Steele, is that the state's
response is different than below.
Correct. Below, the state couched it as there was no detention. The state's response in the briefings that there clearly was a detention, but it was a regulatory-type search under Berger. So the state has abandoned the argument made by counsel below for the state. Our position is that this is not a regulatory inspection. It doesn't look like one. This was not a unit that does licensing inspections. The officer who testified at the suppression hearing didn't even know what the licensing standards were for security guards.
Well, the governor's task force is basically a drug enforcement combined unit, right?
They are a street crimes unit combined of detectives out of Troop 2 and probation officers that basically do car stops and hang out in areas that they think there's drug activity and try to make drug arrests.
That's well, I ask that question because they usually come to us in a circumstance that suggests a constitutional challenge to a search, and it's almost inevitably either drugs or weapons.
Almost always. I'd agree with that.
Okay.
And so they acknowledge, and one of the questions posed to the to Corporal Pop, who's with the task force, was, have you ever done a license inspection before? And he said no. And it's nonsense to think that the state police were there to worry about security guard licenses. They're not in the business of doing that. And what happened here is they got word that the Thunder Guards were there. And what finally was brought out at trial is that they wanted to find out who's in the Thunder Guards. They thought that would be good to know.
When you say they're not in the business of doing that, it is because you're saying that was their subjective state of mind, or is it the intent of the General Assembly that it is their business to do that under 1338?
I don't find anywhere in the General Assembly that they wanted the governor's task force to do regulatory inspections. But I mean, it would be akin.
Let me just read you the language that the state has cited and get your response to it. All police agencies and law enforcement officers of this state may carry out this chapter and enforce compliance therewith. And that's the licensing of security officers.
But under Berger, it deals with businesses that are regularly subjected to, you know, to that kind of thing and to inspections, where it is like with, you know, nursing homes or food and beverage with restaurants, with the automobile industry. And there's no history here that that's ever happened. But more even fundamentally, that statute goes to commercial enterprises. These were voluntary, unpaid security.
Wasn't there evidence that there was going to be a donation to their
chapter?
To their chapter? And isn't that enough to create the commercial relationship and a business?
I don't think so, because the statute clearly says that a security guard is somebody who's employed, which means paid in paychecks. I think a donation to a chapter does not count as a business contract where they were paid.
Well, is there anything in the record that indicates that at any point in time the task force member said, we're here to check your security licenses and we want to make sure that everybody's properly credentialed so you can provide security for the party?
No, they were simply pulled out and wanted to check their identification and information. And what's noteworthy is that after this, they let them go back and conduct security. So there was no citations given, there was no cease and desist orders, there was nothing about you're not qualified to do licensing. They simply were going to get the pedigree information. And
so when they said come out, if they weren't going to ask them about their security credentials, what was the announced purpose for saying everybody come outside?
It's not clear. They simply said you have to come outside and provide identification.
Well, let's assume this is analogous to a pretextual stop for a traffic offense that ultimately results in a traffic offense and then followed up by a search incident for their arrest or any scenario. If they have the authority to do what they did, does it make any difference that their genuine or sincere reason for being there was to get the names of the members of the Thunder Guards for future identification purposes, or even to find out if somebody would voluntarily toss drugs from their person into the weeds or just pop out a bag of something or other and say, oh, and by the way, I have drugs? What difference does it make if they have the authority to do it in the first place?
Well, one, it's a private party. Two, that would be akin to showing up at a beauty parlor and saying, let's have all the beauticians come outside and check for identification, or walking into a school and say, have all the teachers come outside and let's check your credentials to see if you're really a licensed teacher. And in this case, they didn't have the authority. They weren't in the business of.
Well, but what Justice Richard just read to you suggests they do have the authority, and the issue is whether they used it pretextually here for some purpose other than consistent with what they had the authority to do, and if so, what difference does it make?
Well, I'd say when they show up with 12 to 15 troopers en masse and have them come out and then have a semicircle of troopers around the front entrance where all the Thunder Guard securities are gathered, that's not in any way akin to checking for security licenses. That just looks to me very, very pretextual, and it's essentially an information shakedown.
Let's assume hypothetically it is a pretext, and it, unashamedly they admit that it is. It was our excuse for being there, no more than that. But we have the statutory authority to make that check. We don't routinely do it. We certainly don't do it with probation officers as part of the governor's task force, but we did it tonight. And what we did after that, having detained this one individual, what we did after that was perfectly consistent with his constitutional rights and our authority. What's the answer to that?
If the question is, does pretext matter, it certainly does, that they shouldn't be able to use the pretext of we're here to check for, you know, security credentials as a way to do information shakedowns. And that's because I think it's just a very, very slippery slope, and where does that stop in any industry, in any scenario? That they could say we have authority to check for, you know, whatever license it is.
Well, you have a car to stop your automobile to see if you have a driver's license.
But they have a basis to stop the automobile. And in this case, the state's conceded all along that they never had any basis.
Well, the basis was, wasn't it, that the Thunder Guards were providing security, and they might have been providing security without a license to do so for profit.
They would have known that on the front end.
When? Before or after the detention?
Before.
How would they know it before?
How would they know that they were unlicensed? How would they know that they were paid? How would they know they were even qualified for the statute to be checked? They didn't.
Well, if they're providing security, can the police ask them whether they're licensed or for their identification to determine if they're licensed or not? You're saying they cannot even have them come out and show identification?
No, because that's a seizure. I mean, that's like walking into a wedding at a country club and saying, you know, let's have everyone in here that looks Hispanic to see if they have a proper identification or if they're legal. Let's check their INS cards.
Let's ask everyone at the wedding who's having alcohol whether they're of age to have alcohol.
That would be a seizure, though. There'd have to be some reasonable basis.
I thought in this case, a single trooper was at the event earlier, and during that earlier encounter found out who was providing security, and then came back with everyone else. Is that right?
That's exactly what happened. And so at the time, the first trooper was there, and the testimony was he looked like he was just sort of checking the fire exits and getting the lay of the land for more of a safety thing. There was no real questioning or inquiry about, you know, what are you guys doing here? Are you licensed? There was none of that. In fact, the witnesses all said it was short and pleasant, and they just thought he was doing a, you know, kind of a check to see if the building was safe. No one thought anything of it. And then it was an hour later when the party was in full swing. There was no complaints. There were no problems when this cavalry, you know, descended upon the building and had everyone wearing red, the Thunder Guards clothes, to come outside, and then they started giving up, you know, their information. It was in that context when Mr. Jones dropped the contraband.
But once the individual officer found out that a contingent of any group was providing security, wouldn't they have a legitimate interest in seeing if the people were qualified to provide security? Pick another group, any group you want, that may raise concerns about them providing security. Why wouldn't it be a legitimate inquiry to find out if they were qualified?
Well, the question is, why would it take 15 troopers to find that out? Why couldn't that trooper right then and there handle it? And that's why it doesn't in any way resemble anything that would you call regulatory inspection under Berger in those kind of cases. It was a shakedown for information, and so if that was really the concern, and the first trooper said, "Hey, fellows, you know, again, I don't think it applies because they weren't paid and they weren't in the business of providing security," that he could have done that right then and there. And so if you had, you know, if somebody had the University of Delaware football team, you know, provide security at a party, you know, in Newark, you know, for whatever reason, you know, you're going to have 12 to 15 cops show up and say, all right, all the football players outside, we want to see your license. They're not paid. They're volunteering. So it doesn't apply on any level. But even if it does, there's nothing about these facts that resemble what I think you could safely call a regulatory inspection. And there's no history of this unit or state police doing these type of things. And one of the things in Berger is that the industry was on notice. The statute was very clear that there would be inspections, you know, like food and beverage, where the health guy comes in the kitchen to make sure there's no rats or botulism and, you know, alcohol, those kind of things. But this, there's no history here of checking for these kind of things.
Let me come at this from a different direction. Section 1325 requires folks providing security to have a card in their possession. If 12 state troopers showed up and went inside the building and each one went up to one of the Thunder guards and said, may I see your card, would that be a problem? Or is the problem arise only once there's a detention, if you will, and they're herded outside? Because the numbers don't matter, do they, if all they do is walk in and each one goes up to one and says, I want to see the card?
I think a dozen state troopers coming in the building right then and there is a detention. And it's problematic before they even ask for their cards. It's the whole thing of, you know, let me see your papers. And where does that stop? That in any industry, they can come in and just say, let me see your credentials. Walk into a school, into a classroom, confront a teacher, a beauty parlor, massage parlor, chiropractor's office. You know.
Well, there's no statutory requirement to carry a card for a teacher and to be licensed, subject to inspection by the police, though, is there?
But the information still, there's certificates that are on file, but it's still the same kind of thing. And in this case, I think it's just problematic when you have this cavalry, you know, show up and come in and say, let me see your security card, when there's been no complaint about it at all, when they're not paid.
What was the testimony at the trial on why the police said they went there?
The police, it was to check the security thing, but then the officer blurted out that it was good police business to know who are members of motorcycle clubs in Delaware. And that was from answering questions from the prosecutor.
So there's a dual purpose.
And it came out, and I was digging at that during the suppression hearing, and it was always above my pay grade. Lieutenant told me to show up. It was something about security guard licenses, and they didn't, you know, and none of the officers, the higher ups, lieutenants or anyone, were brought in by the state the suppression hearing to talk about this whole security guard thing. So they had an underling come in and testify and says, I really didn't know what was going on. I was told it was about security guard credentials, but I was just following orders. And then at trial, he blurts out that, you know, it's good police business to know who is members of the various motorcycle clubs in Delaware, and that's what this was really about. And the security guard credential thing was just nonsense, and it's pretextual. Clearly, it's what happened.
Well, I mean, that's potentially one inference, I suppose. Another is that there was a dual purpose. They have to enforce the chapter, and in the process of enforcing the chapter, they also learn the identity of the Thunderbirds. Correct?
I don't accept that there was a dual purpose, Justice Ridgely, here at all. I think the part about the security guard credentials they had no interest in that whatsoever, because they sent them all back to the party afterwards. They didn't cease and desist. So if it was really a problem, why didn't they cite anybody? Why didn't they make them leave?
Well, explain to me again why their subjective intent is important if they had the authority to check for the cards.
I don't think
why
it's objective.
Is that significant?
I don't think it is at all. I think it's objective. I think it's they're trying to rely on their subjective intent, which I believe is nonsense and pretextual. So I think you have to look at an objective standard, and the objective standard is you have a cavalry of police come into a private party, order people outside, and then shake them down for information. That's what this case is.
Are you going to talk about the second argument, the search of the residence?
Thank you, Justice Allen, if I could. So quite obviously, if there was a detention and there was no reasonable basis, the fruits of at least part of the fruits of that violation is seen in the March 24th search warrant, which is tainted by the illegal seizure of what happened at the banquet facility. But even putting aside the constitutional violations on March 13th, the four corners of this search warrant fail miserably in establishing that there was probable cause that firearms and drugs would be found at Mr. Jones' residence. Probable cause to arrest is clearly different than probable cause to search. This court has said so in Dorsey. I cited some Superior Court cases. Cannon, Ivins have clearly said the same thing. It's established jurisprudence. And this case, the state police in their four corners, in their affidavit, essentially repackaged a bunch of outdated criminal history and prior searches of the residents, the lion's share having to do with two other family members who were both incarcerated in March 2010 when this warrant was sought. But the information goes back to May of 2003. There was an administrative search, and Marcellus Jones, my client, was charged with a firearm offense. His brother was charged with some drug offenses. They then came back in May of 2003 and did another search warrant, and Marcus was charged again. And then in 2007, Marcus was arrested at that residence as well. Marcus is in jail. He's in prison in March 2010. So all of that information is irrelevant. It has nothing to do with the present time, and there's absolutely nothing in the warrant that would draw a nexus between what happened at the banquet facility and Mr. Jones' residence. There's no surveillance putting him coming and going. There's nothing about foot traffic in and out of the house. There's no informants. There's no controlled buys. There's no hand-to-hand transactions. There's
Was
no
Mr.
statements
Jones,
made.
In custody? Was he arrested and placed in custody once the drugs were found on the ground?
At the bank facility, yes.
Okay. So did he have an opportunity to go home?
He did. He made bail, and he had an opportunity to go home.
Okay. And there was no search warrant applied for on the date of the arrest?
No, sir.
When was it applied for?
It was the day or the day before, which was March 24th. It was 11 days later is when it was sought. But there was nothing,
day before what? The day of or the day before what?
The search warrant was executed on March 24th. Okay. So it was 11 days after the incident at the banquet facility is when they got the search warrant for his residence. There was nothing that happened in the interim other than the fact that he made bail.
Was that in the warrant that he made bail or did not make bail?
I'm pretty sure it was that he made bail and listed his residence in the court paperwork for the early arrest as being, you know, Liberty Road, wherever he lived. So that was it. But there was nothing at all about anything criminal related to the residence. So
what does the warrant say about why they thought drugs would be there at all?
It doesn't. That's the problem. It simply said there's a long criminal history, 2003, 2007, with his family, and we arrested him at the banquet facility in March, and then they had some boilerplate stuff, and that's it. But there's nothing at all that talks about why they thought there was any criminal activity at the house in March 2010 when the warrant was sought.
Would it be different if they immediately applied for the warrant at the time of the arrest at the banquet facility and he hadn't had an opportunity to go home?
Make no difference to my line of thinking. Judge Eagleman wrote a great opinion in Cannon's where Mr. Cannon was seen by the police leaving his residence and information about him selling drugs generally, and then they see him get into a car, and then they see him meet with some other guys and some hand-to-hand stuff. So they arrested him, they find drugs in him, and they immediately go to a search warrant at his house, and Judge Ailman said that that's not enough. The fact that he's out in town doing things, you have to tie the drug activity to the place to be searched with his residence, and the fact that he's out in town, you know, dealing isn't enough. You need something more. And in this case, it's even worse because you have, you know, it's 11 days and they don't even see him going to and from his house on the day in question. They don't run into him until the banquet facility. He wasn't even on their radar screen. So there's nothing here that ties him to the residence in terms of the criminality that took place at the banquet facility.
There's case law out there that suggests that when someone is engaged in a criminal enterprise such as drug dealing, that it is likely that some of the warehousing is done at home, some of the weapons are kept at home, some of the cash is kept at home. Why isn't that a reasonable inference to be drawn by a police officer based on his experience and training?
I studied a bunch of cases in my brief that addressed that very issue about the boilerplate language. There still has to be some type of factual nexus that links that speculation to the residence, and there's none here.
So the fact that
generally speaking, drug dealers keep stuff in their house, generally speaking, in other cases we've seen that, it's not enough. There has to be something more. Because otherwise, every time someone gets arrested for a drug offense, then automatically you get a free search of their residence. And that's a different equation because it goes to the place to be searched, not the person for whom was arrested.
Phil, I'm afraid you're out of time.
I am. Thank you, Justice.
And I'm learning this morning that I should alert people as soon as their rebuttal begins because they tend to go through their rebuttals. All of your time is gone.
Thank you, Justice.
Well, thank you for thanking me, but I don't feel you should be grateful. Sorry.
May it please the court, and good afternoon. Deputy Attorney General Gregory Smith on behalf of the state. Your Honor, I'll start with the plumber and pipe fitter hall. When the Delaware State Police went to the plumber and pipe fitter's hall, they were going there for two reasons. They were going there to enforce the security licensing statute, Chapter 13 of Title 24. And yes, as they acknowledged in their testimony, they were also hoping to gather some intelligence on the Thunder Guards.
And does the record reflect that they asked anyone to show their identification card or their license?
The record reflects that they... Let me say specifically no. The record does not reflect a question of, I need to see your security license card. The record reflects that the police asked them to come out to produce identification, and that identification that they would then take to determine whether they could be properly licensed security guards.
But does the record reflect that they knew they were unlicensed in providing security ostensibly without payment?
No, Your Honor. The record does not reflect whether the police knew they had licenses or were totally unlicensed. No.
So they basically said, please come out and everyone show us your driver's license.
Yes, Your Honor. And that's certainly reflected by the testimony of Michael Trustee, who was one of the Thunder Guards, not obviously Mr. Jones, and who did testify at the suppression hearing. And he said his testimony was the police asked the Thunder Guards to come out. They did. They were just asked to produce identification, and most of the Thunder Guards did. Mr. Jones was not one of those. Mr. Trustee also testified that once those Thunder Guards who had produced their identification had done so, they were allowed to return. He also testified, though, that they chose not to go back inside. So after they had been allowed to go back in, they wanted to stay there for whatever reason, their own curiosity to stick up for their friends. It doesn't matter. There's nothing bad with them staying outside. But at that point, the police were enforcing Chapter 13 of Title 24, and there was no pat down, there was no frisk of those Thunder Guards, so they were following the licensing enforcement as they were authorized to by the General Assembly. And if I may contrast with what counsel used as a comparison to teachers and hairdressers and other professions, the General Assembly hasn't authorized the police to conduct licensure enforcement of any and all professions, but they've specifically authorized the police to do that for security guards. And it certainly makes sense. I mean, you're expecting security guards to be people who are, you know, they may be armed, and there's, you know, they may be bigger folks. You'd like to have somebody who has the wherewithal to deal with those kind of people. And so the question under New York v. Berger, pretext, frankly, doesn't matter. In that case, the court, the U.S. Supreme Court, was faced with an auto parts dealership, a junkyard, and frankly, the overlap between the licensing of the auto parts dealerships and looking for a charge of receiving stolen property, the goals are virtually identical. And the U.S. Supreme Court acknowledged that. And the fact that the goals are either identical or overlapping, that's not a problem. The question is, do police exceed the scope of their licensing enforcement And here they clearly did not. This was they temporarily brought the Thunder Guards out. They asked for their identification, and then they said, we're done with you. Now, in Mr. Jones' case, he apparently, I guess he panicked. That's just my own description of it. And he decided to sort of stroll away from the group, kind of near a cigarette disposal, and he dropped some cocaine. He abandoned it at that point. And it was only after that that the police conducted what would be a search incident to arrest to pat him down and find the almost $3,000 in cash on his person, as well as the 40 pills of oxycodone.
Where in Chapter 13 of Title 24 do you find the authority for the police to detain someone pursuant to the asking for identification?
Your Honor, I'm not sure that the word detain appears in there. But at the same time, it's the state's position that in order to actually request that identification someone, the police would physically have to approach them, stop them, and say, will you produce your ID, please?
But there's a difference between coming up and asking someone for identification and saying, thou shalt walk outside and stand still till I can deal with you.
Yes, Your Honor, I agree that there is. In this case,
where does the authority for that extra step come from in the regulatory scheme?
I'm not going to be able to point to a specific place in that statute. I would direct the court's attention to the facts here, that this was a party with approximately 200 guests, and from an operational standpoint, it would be a lot safer to, when the police were going to have an encounter, to have them removed, separated from the rest of the crowd to do that.
What's the record tell us about the motivation of the police to pull the Thunder Guards away from the gathering for safety purposes?
Your Honor, I don't believe the record. I believe the record's silent on that point.
So you're asking us to speculate as to why it was done the way it was done.
I'd rather not phrase it that way, Your Honor, but I can see how Your Honor would say that. I'm asking Your Honor to draw a reasonable inference from the record. That's what the state's asking the court to do.
And that reasonable inference would be, it seems a lot more practical to ask them to leave a room full of 200 other people to check their identity to determine whether or not they were licensed or whatever the question may have been or not. It's simply separating or segregating them from a larger crowd made sense under the circumstances.
Yes, Your Honor. I'm sorry.
Mr. Smith, just for my clarification, the encounter that took place during the security license inspection, was that a seizure or not in the view of the state?
Your Honor, it's not a seizure where there was reasonable articulable suspicion to believe that criminal conduct had taken place. That did not exist for a seizure pursuant to the Fourth Amendment. That's why this had to be an investigatory detention pursuant to Chapter 13 of Title 24.
And what was the basis for the Superior Court's ruling?
Your Honor, the Superior Court did mention the investigatory aspect and then made a decision that there wasn't a detention. The state
was not a detention.
Not a detention at all. And Your Honor, in reviewing the record, the state in good faith could not say that people being asked to leave, there's not a detention of any kind. Certainly that detention ended, and it ended very shortly after the enforcement of the licensure inspection was done.
It was an administrative detention, not a seizure for Fourth Amendment purposes.
Correct, Your Honor.
And you're saying that the authority to conduct that administrative detention is implicit somewhere in Chapter 13 of Title 24?
Yes, Your Honor. Just as in the New York v. Berger, the junkyard case, certainly the junkyard owner is going to be conducting business. And when the police come in there and say, okay, you know, show us your records for this, they're going to be directed to stop doing whatever business they're doing. And that's just the price of being involved in a regulated industry. And here the General Assembly has chosen rationally to regulate security guards.
Well, the problem is that, you know, once you premise the legitimacy of what the police did based on an implicit authority, you know, where do you draw the line? That is, how do you differentiate it from, you know, a seizure for constitutional purposes without any reasonable or articulable suspicion?
No, I'm sorry. I understand now, Your Honor. The way to draw that line is based on the police conduct. If the police conduct, if when they brought the Thunder Guards out, they just immediately started patting them down, frisking them, and saying, officer safety, that would be something where reasonable articulable suspicion was needed. But because the police conduct was consistent with the licensure statutes, then that's where the line is. And they've stayed on the proper side of that line.
Okay, the statute, I gather, authorizes the police to enforce the license requirement. But it
yes.
doesn't say anything about how the police should go about doing that.
I guess that's fair to say, Your Honor. It does not give the detail of...
Okay, so what are the boundaries, then? By what rules do we determine the boundaries in assessing the propriety of whether or not the police carried out in a proper way their authority?
This court's able to view that, and like all Fourth Amendment situations, under a totality of the circumstances, it's often not going to be a neat line to be able to draw, and that's
unless I misunderstand the facts of this case. At the point people are asked for identification, the only alleged search that follows a detention is the search of their wallet by asking them to pull out their identification.
Correct, Your
Where
Honor.
Was the search here? Where's the unreasonable search and seizure? When what I understand the facts to be is that with somebody ambled a bit off from the crowd, a trooper was close enough to hear a sound in the weeds. The sound, he investigated what may have been thrown that produced the sound or why the sound occurred, and he found drugs. Where's the search?
Your Honor, the state's position is there was no search. Certainly there was a search incident to arrest of Marcellus Jones that revealed the cash and the 40 oxycodone.
The initial contact that caused them to have some reason to believe there was more to this than simply a private person engaged for the evening as security guard without a license was produced by something unconnected with what the police were doing.
Yes, Your
Honor.
Sound
in the weeds.
Yes, Your Honor.
Go ahead.
Is it your position that the inspection that is authorized under New York versus Berger includes a detention? Because I'm looking at that case, and it seems to be talking about inspection. Isn't that different from a detention?
Well, Your Honor, I'm not sure there's any other way to conduct the inspection to see for police to see that a security guard has a license other than if let's say Wack and Hut Security is going around patrolling a parking lot and state police, you know, see that vehicle and they want to check to make sure the driver of that vehicle is licensed, they're actually going to need to stop him and say, may I see your license? there's simply no other way to look at the license to see if someone has that license other than to physically, momentarily stop them.
So inspection includes, and we should apply the same analysis for a detention, provided it's reasonable in scope?
Yes, provided that the detention is limited in scope to the regulatory scheme, and which it certainly was in this case.
So we don't run into not enough time to address the second issue. You ready to talk about the search warrant?
Yes, Your Honor. Thank you. Turning to the search of Mr. Jones' home, the suggestion that this was merely a boilerplate search warrant is certainly not appropriate. There is some language in there that undoubtedly appears in more than one warrant where the officer articulated that drug dealers are likely to store the contraband associated with their business at their home. But the warrant certainly did not stop there. The triggering event was this arrest at the Plumber and Pipe Fitters Hall. Then in connection with that, the police articulated several incidents to provide a nexus to that location. There were searches that took place in 2003. The first one of those searches.
And what year did all of these events occur in? Jones events?
Different years. The first two events.
No, not the prior years. What year was Jones' house searched?
And I'm sorry.
2010, 2009?
That led to the.
This appeal?
Yes, 2009, Your Honor.
So you're saying that a search in 2003 was relevant to searching in 2009?
Yes, Your Honor. That is the state's position that under the totality of the circumstances, the magistrate was entitled to look at each one of these things. And while each one of these little pieces, if all the state had brought in that warrant was something bad happened at this house, drugs were found in 2003, it's not the state's position that that would be enough.
Yeah, but let's look at the other end of the spectrum. Is it enough to say we arrested Jones 10 days earlier at a separate event, and now we want to search his residence?
No, Your Honor. It's not the state's position that the state would have an automatic ability to get a search warrant when somebody is arrested with, trafficking weight, something that shows that he's a drug dealer, not just a simple user.
So if that's not enough, then one question would be whether the 2003 information that led to the arrest and incarceration of another family member is stale 6 years later.
And that's not an unreasonable question, but it's something that this court has considered in Gardner as far as staleness. Now, in Gardner, that was, I believe, a two-year break. But 2003 is not the only year we're talking about, Your Honor. There were two searches in 2003, and certainly Mr. Jones, and I guess I should say Marcellus Jones, since there was a brother, Marcus Jones, they were both living at that 1003 Liberty
What's
Road.
What's the closest year you have to 2009?
In 2007, the county police arrested three people who tried to rob 1003 Liberty Road residence for weapons and drugs. That they weren't successful, but certainly police can rely on that as something to say, well, there's still drug activity going on there. Why are other criminals going to try to get into this house for weapons and drugs unless they actually believe there are some there? And that was at one point in 2007. Then later in 2007.
The 2007 was an arrest of people unrelated to Jones for breaking into Jones' house. Is that what you're saying?
Yes, Your Honor. I believe Bryant Harris was that name of that arrestee, at least one of them.
When you used the word rob, does that mean they confronted people who had in their possession drugs and guns?
Yeah, it was attempted robbery, attempted robbery charge.
Wasn't a burglary, it was a robbery.
Yes, at that house. Then after that attempted...
So the warrant says, we arrested Jones 10 days earlier at a different location for drugs, and we'd like to search his residence because it was... There was a robbery there 2 years ago by people who were looking for drugs.
That's part of it, yes, Your Honor. And then a fourth thing that the warrant alleges, later in 2007, police conducted a controlled purchase of drugs from 1003 Liberty Road, and then they were able to obtain and execute a search warrant based on that that yielded both crack and marijuana.
Well, don't you think that the police either thought they solved the problem in 2007 with that arrest, or they would have followed up in the 2 years after that?
Your Honor, I certainly would hope they had solved it, but then clearly with having Marcellus Jones found now just 11 days before this with more drugs and money, clearly the problem had not been solved. And that's why it's appropriate for the magistrate who was reviewing this warrant to have looked at each one of those things. And while each one individually, certainly standing alone, the state's position is, would not be enough, but when taken together, there was enough for a magistrate to sign off on that warrant.
That's what I want to ask you about, just to clarify exactly where the state is. If there were no prior incidents involving that home, would the state be arguing that the affidavit in support of the warrant was sufficient?
No, Your Honor. There need to be something else, another nexus to connect.
If the only prior incident involving the home was the 2003 incident, would that be sufficient?
Probably not, Your Honor.
Okay. And what about the first 2007 incident?
And let me make sure I understand Your Honor's question. If all that were articulated in the warrant for the nexus were one of the 2007 incidents being the attempted robbery?
Either that or in combination with the 2003.
Okay, so having both the 2003 incidents plus the attempted robbery.
Now, what was the tipping point, Mr. Smith?
The tipping point is this most recent arrest with this quantity of drugs and money with the history of the house.
So we can ignore the others?
No, Your Honor. The state certainly doesn't want the court to ignore the others. That's.
But legally speaking, that's frosting on the cake. What's essential and sufficient, I gather from your argument, is the second 2007 incident.
Yes, Your Honor. That's a fair assessment.
I suppose one of the inferences that the magistrate was asked to draw is this person's been arrested with drugs, he's out on bail, he's going to go home and keep possessing guns, drugs, and everything else, even though he's out on bail. Was there a condition of bail that he abide by the law, et cetera?
Your Honor, I can't say I've reviewed his bail conditions, but I guess I'm going to assume that not committing other crimes is a standard condition of bail. I don't want to make that a 100% representation of the court because I haven't looked at that in his case. But I think with that, Your Honor, the state would pray that this court affirm the judgment of the Superior Court and give the deference to the magistrate's review of this warrant that it historically has given. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. We'll take the case under advisement and recess.
Thank you.